You know, I haven't heard from that guy, but I gotta tell you what he wants from me. And I gotta tell you, there's no way. He wants my soul. And I was struggling to explain how this was a question of my integrity. I said, I have to let him know there's no deal makeable here. This is not something that's for sale. And Richard Brooks looked me in the eye and he said, you know what? Screw him. And we started shooting the picture. I've always wondered, did Richard say something to the studio? Did he say, you're forcing me to find another person on such short notice, I can't do it, and it's going to cost me to delay, and it's going to cost the studio money? I don't know what he said, or if indeed he said anything. Maybe the guy himself began to say, Jesus Christ, what am I doing here? Whatever happened, all I know for sure is that I never heard from that guy again. Not long after that, I finished the movie. I was back in New York, and I got a call from David Susskind, the television producer. He said, I've got a script that's just the greatest, and I want you to play it. He sent it to me, and it was fabulous. Something called A Man is 10 Feet Tall. I loved the title. It really spoke to what the movie was about. I told David, I love it. I want to do it. He said, great. We've got a deal. We were just about to go into rehearsal, no contracts yet, when I got a call from an NBC guy who said, could you come in? So I went in to see him, and again he gave me this form to sign. It was a loyalty oath, and once again it made a point of asking me to disassociate myself from this man I so greatly admired, Paul Robeson. Well, at this point I couldn't hold what was inside. I didn't permit it to explode, you know. I was much more in control than that, but I couldn't hide my feelings. I told him that the man he was talking about was a man I respected a great deal, and yes, I knew him, and yes, I liked him. I liked the fact that he was a stand-up guy. He was a good person to me, I said, and I could not and would not, under any circumstances, be a party to anything that denigrated him. To sum it all up, I said, thank you very much, but no thanks, and I left. I called David Susskind and told him what the situation was, and he said, let me have a go at this. I said, fine, but I went on to explain that I simply couldn't do this. I knew all about the right-wing, left-wing tug-of-war stuff. I was perfectly capable of interpreting it on the basis of how it affected me as a young black man in America. My political awareness had matured by then. Yes. I was definitely by then inclined towards the left of center. Yes, there I found more people like Philip Rose and David Susskind, people demonstrating a genuine willingness to receive me as an equal. This was reason enough, I suppose, for the FBI to keep an eye on me, given the fear and panic of those terrible Cold War days of madness, a time in which a young African-American male was at odds with his time and in constant search for answers to the core conflicts in his life. Conflicts that had little or nothing to do with politics and everything to do with the cultural forces rooted inside him and the multitude of daily surrenders demanded of him by their social surroundings. Balance is what he was looking for, but he hadn't yet learned its name. In time, he will come to know it as a state of being. It can only be found at a place that is widely believed not to exist. Truth is that there is a place of space that does exist between two opposites everywhere, and somewhere therein dwells a point at which balance can be found. The people who were kind to me were kind to me, you know. If I had dug into their motives, I might have found that they were politically different from me or maybe politically in tune with me. Yes, I knew liberals and progressives and Democrats and Republicans and fellow travelers, communists, anarchists, Bolsheviks, Trotskyites. But whatever they were was their choice, and they were free to choose. Blacklist or no, I was determined that I was going to be an actor because I felt a deep connection between myself and the craft. And blacklist or no, I swore I'd find jobs. Or I'd work in little theater. I'd work in off-Broadway theater. I'd work in Harlem. I'd work as a porter or a janitor or whatever I could find to support my family. I would go out and work as a carpenter's helper if need be, which I did. I was fine working in the little restaurant and washing my dishes and putting on the barbecue and selling it for 80 cents a meal. I would far rather wash dishes and work over a grill any day than sign a loyalty oath I considered repugnant. But some weeks later, I got a call from David Susskind, and he said to me, "I want to go into rehearsal." I said, "David, what do you mean? I told you I can't sign that thing." He said, "Listen, I think those guys are nuts. Let's just go into rehearsal and see." So we started in, and we did that play, and it was a bombshell. The story was about this guy working on the docks, the only black guy in the gang, and a white kid drifts on, a kid from the South, and he gets hired and put in the same gang that I'm in, and he turns out to be a wonderful kid with a remarkably philosophical outlook on life. He and I became very close friends, to the chagrin of the bad guys. It was like a morality play. It was a wonderful presentation on television, and later we did it as a film. It was called Edge of the City on the big screen. For the television show, which aired October 21, 1955 on NBC, the part of my wife was played by a young actress named Hilda Sims. She was a very fair-complected African-American woman who had become a star on Broadway playing Anna Lucasta. Her complexion was so fair that on the black and white television screen of the day, she looked white. Well, when we went on the air that evening, the switchboard at NBC lit up. It was jammed. Do you hear me when I tell you? I mean jammed. Jammed from the first scene throughout the whole teleplay, which ran for an hour, live television, a Philco Playhouse presentation. The Philco people were deluged with letters as well, people writing about this being such a scandal, such an issue. The critics, for the most part, thought the piece was excellent, but the country just wasn't used to it. The wonderful irony, of course, is that Hilda Sims was black, just not black enough to suit the country's perception at that moment. The curious thing about being an outsider is that you never know where your guardian angels are lurking. Had that MGM studio guy called back, I would have said, "Hey, I can't oblige you. What you want me to do is sign away my loyalty. You are messing with my dignity." Had he called back, and I'd said that to him, I wouldn't have gotten work at MGM, you follow? And the guy at NBC, when I said, "No, I'm out of here," and left, did that guy say to David, "Look, I talked to the kid and he didn't give much, but listen, what are we doing here? Why don't you go ahead and make your movie?" Again, I don't know what happened. All I know for sure is that whatever list I was on that prompted these encounters with studio and network attorneys didn't, in the end, have any discernible effect on my career. By the same token, these were the days of the big studio contracts. In Blackboard Jungle, the kid who played the bad guy, Vic Morrow, was offered a contract at MGM. All the other guys were talking about who else was being considered for a contract, but it never entered my mind that there was a chance of that for me. The great good fortune in that situation is that I never was considered, because had I been considered, the temptation would have been to accept. That's guaranteed salary, you know. I probably would have wound up on suspension more often than not, because I probably wouldn't have done the stuff they offered me. But by remaining an outsider in the free market, I was able to pick and choose my projects, which led to work I can still stand behind. Work informed by my life experiences, work aligned with my values. In 1955, I was sent to Atlanta to do publicity for Blackboard Jungle. I went down primarily to do black newspapers and black radio. When I was done, I was at the airport ready to leave, but I was hungry and decided to have a bite. So I went to a very nice restaurant where all the waiters were black. The maitre d', dressed in a tuxedo himself, was black. He recognized me, I suppose, from some movie. I appeared at the entrance to this restaurant, and he said, "May I help you?" I said, "Yes, I'd like a table." I saw his eyes widen a bit. "Are you alone?" he asked. I said, "Yes." He said, "Mr. Poitier, I'm sorry. I could give you a table, but we're going to have to put a screen around you." And I said to him, I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, it's the practice here. It's the law." I looked into his eyes, and I could see that he was pained by having to do this. I could tell it. I could smell it. For him, another black man, to be saying, "We do have a table, but we'll have to put a screen around you," it must have hurt. So I said, "Well, no thank you." And I walked away feeling for the man. Not feeling for myself, because I was getting out of there. But I was also somewhat impervious, because that wasn't me. The me they saw and wanted to put a screen around didn't exist to me. But did I feel some outrage? Of course. Did I feel angry? Yes. But I took it in stride, because this moment of absurdity was in fact so totally unremarkable. To African Americans in 1955, this kind of insult was old hat. So I digested it, and I went on with my life to fight other battles, as I had to, but I never accommodated it. In 1955, if the nation had cared to take an honest look, it would have seen the approaching civil rights storm kicking up dust on the horizon, coming perhaps to seek out the young, quiet preacher of the gospel, destined to lead the way across the difficult and painful years ahead. In fact, before 1955 had passed into history, Martin Luther King Jr.'s appearance on the national scene seemed to have no end in sight. A Patch of Blue. Brent Staples did a piece in the New York Times not long ago saying that when white kids run amok, it's time for soul-searching in America, time to figure out our ills. But the problems of black kids always remain other and somehow apart. When we did Black Boy Jungle, there were forces in the country, Claire Booth Luce among them, that described the film as un-American. They thought it was a misrepresentation of American high school education. Well, it certainly wasn't the kind of school Mrs. Luce's kids would have attended. There were a couple of Hispanic kids, some black kids, and all the kids were lower income. It was a vocational school in New York City, a school for the incorrigibles and kids who weren't doing too well. The message coming loud and clear from these critics of our film was, "This isn't us." But Richard Brooks, the film's director, had a different message. "Yes, it is. This is us, too." The film's theme had to do with courage and belonging. Those issues were presented within the context of how an ethnically and racially mixed class of Hard Knocks kids moved and changed over time. The individuals in that classroom came to certain realizations having to do with courage, self-perception, and the abuse of power. All of these elements were very creatively orchestrated. Further animating this already lively mix, the producer added rock and roll to the soundtrack. Let me tell you, in the mid-50s, with my character's alienated and uncooperative presence in that classroom, challenging the authority of the teacher but winding up an ally of his on some level, and with Bill Haley and the Comets singing Rock Around the Clock, well, the result was an electric jolt. Blackboard Jungle was made in 1954, the year of Brown versus Board of Education, but that court decision notwithstanding, black schools at that time were invisible to white America. This was the era of the Andrew Sisters and Perry Como in terms of popular entertainment. Hit Parade was the big show on television and the big cultural barometer. The sit-in of the civil rights movement wouldn't begin for quite a few years. In 1954, the issue of race was still damn near unchanged from when I got off the boat in Florida in 1943. Back then, I couldn't go into certain stores and try on a pair of shoes. If I wanted something from a restaurant outside the community in which I was confined, I had to go to a back door. If I rode the bus, I was in the back of the bus. If I wanted to take a train, I was in the Jim Crow car. Thurgood Marshall was running around the country bringing suits at various places, but America wasn't ready for change. Most folks didn't want to hear the news. I made $750 a week for Blackboard Jungle, and I was overjoyed. That was a monumental amount for me, but still, I knew it wasn't going to change my life. I went back to New York, back to Riverside Drive at 147th Street, back to my restaurant empire, which had grown to three establishments, only one of which was profitable. We were on a slide, and before long, the whole thing fell apart. When my partner and I dissolved our relationship, he took the one decent location, and I was left with the two others, which also left me at my wit's end. Here I was, a well-known face in the movies, with my only form of consistent income, a business that wasn't working, with three children to support and no money. My father-in-law was a master bricklayer. After a bit of soul-searching, I went to him and asked if he could teach me how to lay bricks. My brother-in-law was designated as the teacher. He took me up to 126th Street to a two-family house with a tiny backyard owned by a friend of his, another bricklayer. The two of them set me up with a stack of bricks and some cement in a corner of the backyard and got me going with plumb line and the white string to keep the rows straight. I tried and tried. I just couldn't get it right. After several tries, it was evident I didn't have the knack, and I decided to abandon the program. I went home and I told my wife, "Don't worry, I'll get a job." And I meant it. I'd been a carpenter's helper once before. I even once had a job stacking barrels of nails. I'd spent a whole day lugging those babies from the front entrance of the building into a crawl space under the floor at the rear of the building and stacking them under there in a row of threes. That one was a backbreaker, let me tell you, but I managed it because I had to. Of all my father's teachings, the most enduring was the one about the true measure of a man. That true measure was how well he provided for his children. And it stuck with me as if it were etched in my brain. I didn't know where I was going next, but I knew that failure wasn't an option. The restaurant was once and for all finito. I went next door to the little newsstand and tobacco shop. I gave the owner all the foodstuff that was left over and whatever fixtures he could use, and I closed the doors. I owed back rent, so I had to leave the rest of the equipment, and then I just walked away. That's when I got the call from Richard Brooks to make Something of Value in Kenya, and from there my career really took off. This was still 1950 America, however, an America in which a career like this had never even been dreamed of for an outsider of color. It had never happened before in the history of the movie business, a black leading man. I was in the midst of a revolutionary process with this institution I was so at odds with. but my eye was still on the nature of things, not the career. I was only doing what seemed natural to me, but I knew in the larger scheme of things that it was far from natural, and that it didn't obviate what was going on in everyday America. There was still gross unfairness in jobs all around me, in living space, in the manner in which black Americans were received. I saw the truth clear as could be. The explanation for my career was that I was instrumental for those filmmakers who had a social conscience, men like Daryl Zanuck, Joe Mankiewicz, the Mirisch brothers, Ralph Nelson, Mike Frankovich, Martin Ritt, James Clavell, David Susskind, men who, in their careers, felt called to address some of the issues of their day. With my earnings from Something of Value, I was able to buy a two-family house in Mount Vernon, New York, for $27,000. We lived in the ground-floor apartment with three kids and a fourth on the way, in what was a mixed but mostly black community. Among our neighbors, an extraordinary bunch, were Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. It was a middle-class neighborhood made up of people with either solid professions or secure jobs. Ossie, Ruby, and I knew we represented a slight departure from the norm. Black actors earning as much as a middle-class living amounted to less than 1% of all black actors in the profession. The handful of those lucky enough to have employment had to be constantly mindful of the uncertainties attendant to such fragile statistics, and keep an eye out in case the winds of fortune should shift unnoticed and blow them back beyond the poverty line. Through training passed down from all the earlier generations who had to be careful where they walked on the sidewalk, we had the radar to pick up vibrations, good and bad, moving in our direction. Especially when threatening situation arose, all judgment calls required clearance by intuition as a court of last resort. Only then would a course of action be determined. In 1958, I did another picture, The Defiant Ones, that took some heat. Here, a good portion of the controversy came from my friends in the black community. It was a Stanley Kramer film written by some very intense and committed progressives, based on their own convictions about race in America. The story was about two fugitives from a chain gang, one white, one black, literally bound together, at least at the beginning, who could never maneuver their way safely through the system. Each misunderstood the other, but they also misunderstood their own individual limitations, so they scapegoated each other. They weren't able to clearly define what class was, what race was. They experienced poverty, but they couldn't objectively characterize it over and above the fact that they didn't have any money in their pockets. They were simply poor, and that pissed them off. And each used the other to justify his anger until each discovered that the real difficulty was within himself. Stanley Kramer's message in the film was that all people are fundamentally the same. Our differences are, for the most part, cosmetic. The character played by Tony Curtis demonstrated that the society we had constructed wasn't too kind to a goodly number of people who weren't black, who weren't Hispanic, who weren't Asian, who weren't Native American. Some of the people being given a tough time were Irish, and some were Italians, and some were French, and some were Spanish, and some were Eastern European. Modern society wasn't too terrific to many of them, at times, to most of them. Greed and cruelty are pretty widely distributed throughout humanity, as are their victims. You can have oppression of one sort or another all across the board, culturally speaking. All across the board, racially speaking. All across the board, religiously speaking. The down-and-out characters played by Tony Curtis and me in The Defiant Ones weren't willing to give any credence to this commonality until their experience thrust it right up in their faces and they could no longer ignore it. That's why, at the end, they wound up on that railroad trestle, one guy holding the other guy, struggling to survive, hanging on, but singing a song of hope. They're interchangeable, these two guys. The slight difference, very slight difference, of one being white and one being black obscures all the other issues about the nature of society. To lay all of society's ills on racial differences is simplistic. Nonetheless, there was criticism of The Defiant Ones. A small but highly vocal subset of viewers loved the film but took exception to the ending. They were saying, essentially, we are not ready for oneness. Only this time, the sentiment was from the black perspective. Certain of my friends in the Hollywood community wanted more of a sense of satisfaction from the ending, a payback satisfaction, you follow? The moment that set up the final scene is when Tony Curtis was unable to run as fast as I had to catch the moving freight train that had become our last chance for escape. He had tried with all his might to reach my outstretched hand and hold on. At one point, in fact, our hands almost clasped. Another inch was all he needed. But then his fingers began to slip away from mine. It was at that moment that I tumbled off the train too, following him. So what my friends were questioning was whether I should have stayed on the train and said, "The hell with that guy." I explained that the scene in question had been clearly designed by the writers and the director to demonstrate that something had happened in the arc of both characters, something powerful enough that my character felt compelled to make that sacrifice for a friend. My adjustment as an actor for playing the scene as written was the thought that maybe we'll get to the bottom of the hill and be able to take off, or the posse might assume we're still on the train. Nevertheless, from the point of view of those friends, my character's tumbling off the train added an unsatisfactory note to the tag of the film. People who saw it that way would have let Tony Curtis go to suffer his fate, whatever that was, and they would have stayed on the train. Now, if I'd been in my character's shoes in real life, what would I have done? Truth is, I'm not altogether sure where I would have come down. But as a professional actor, my job was to create the character with the sensibility to conduct himself in the way he behaved at the end. And that's exactly how I played him. The movie's point of view was Stanley Kramer's. And I'm very happy to say now in retrospect that it was a good choice on his part and on the writer's part, and indeed on my part for playing the character as it was written. It was a message of tolerance that has stood up pretty well, given the fact the picture was made over 40 years ago. By the end of the movie, the two characters had each made peace with that part of the self that they had come to terms with in the other. Tony's character was lying there in my arms in bad shape, but making jokes about our situation. And he pulled the whole thing together by saying, in effect, "There's much about you that is me, and there's much about me that is you, and I'm comfortable with that." The movie ended before viewers could question how long this comfort would last, or where it would lead, or how profound it was. But it seems to me that the kind of realization Tony's character came to doesn't fade. You may ignore it. You may find that it becomes advantageous politically or socially to ignore it later in life, but you can't erase it, because it's an experience that takes root down at the deepest level of commonality, down where all of us were molded out of the same clay. For myself, I rarely have the desire to stick it to people. It's enough for me to know that I've held myself in good standing with me, you see. It's enough for me to be able to look at the film and say, that represents me well. That's how I would like people to see me. I would like them to see me as a person who has some value unto himself. And there it is. But when I'm done wrong by someone, I'm not above putting that person on the rack in my mind, you know? I rage against the misdeed by devising all kinds of responses and reactions that would dissipate my anger. But it's all in imaginary form. Then I become sorry for the thoughts and contemplate forgiveness. In this life of mine, I can't recall any situation in which forgiveness hasn't ultimately been the settlement. However, getting to forgiveness hasn't necessarily been a rapid transition. Still, I level out with most such relationships at least cleansed of the rancor, if not intact. And I live better with the situation, even if a relationship is altered irreparably in some way. Governor Wallace, before his death, said he was sorry for what he had done, and he spoke of the harm and the pain his views and actions had caused. Jesse Jackson went to see him, and I think a form of absolution took place. When you genuinely and sincerely apologize for harm and pain, it's a sign that your life has taken you to another place from where you were when you caused the harm and pain and had no apologies to make. But the process is never simple, and words can never undo lives destroyed. We've been at this game of human history for a long time, and yet, in just the past few years, we've witnessed hundreds of thousands of people in Rwanda, in Kosovo, in Bosnia, and elsewhere, tortured and killed in the name of ethnic differences. We all have a history whose centuries are replete with genocide and attempted genocide. What humanity has perpetrated goes by different names at different times. What began in Central and South America in the name of Ferdinand and Isabella culminated at the Little Bighorn and Wounded Knee. We call it exploring the New World. But it caused millions of deaths and the absolute elimination of cultures. Today, maybe the majority of countries aren't involved in such cruelties, but the majority of countries really have been. It's generally one country, and then another, and then maybe a war between three countries or four. So here we are at the dawn of a new millennium, and how much closer are we to the enlightenment that would take us beyond such behavior? It might very well be that all we are going to get is an opportunity to rail against the darkness and to hope and dream and imagine and expect that one day our species, in the form of our children or our grandchildren or some progeny in generations to come, will arrive at that place. In 1964, I was awarded the Oscar for Best Actor for my performance in Lilies of the Field, the first African-American so honored. Did I say to myself, this country is waking up and beginning to recognize that certain changes are inevitable? No, I did not. I knew that we hadn't overcome because I was still the only one. My career was unique in all of Hollywood. I knew that I was a one-man show, and it simply shouldn't be that way. And yet, in a way, I found the accolade itself quite natural. I wasn't surprised that such good things were happening to me because I'd never seen myself as less than I am. When I realized I could be a better-than-utilitarian actor, I realized that I had the responsibility, not as a black man, but as an artist, to exercise tremendous discipline. I knew the public would take my measure, and that was constantly in my calculations. By this time, my family had moved to a 7-acre estate in Pleasantville, New York, a huge place in a very upscale community where we were treated very well. I remember the ladies who came as a welcoming committee, all white, and told us about the community. Our kids played with their kids, and our kids had no difficulty in the public schools. Often in the 1960s and 1970s, I stayed at many of New York City's finest hotels, always without incident, treated with respect on every occasion. Likewise in restaurants, stores, theaters, and of course all public-supported venues, none of which should be taken to mean that racism wasn't painfully evident in other ways, in other forms. Still, while that great city was no racial paradise, she was, without question, seductive as hell. She was, in addition, a clear-cut improvement over Mississippi. There was, of course, no city or state that didn't have its atmosphere of racial attitudes. Black artists traveling still had problems with accommodations, for example. And that, of course, was nothing compared to the struggles of millions of ordinary black folk in this country who were having a very hard time. Love for Duke Ellington or Nat Cole couldn't obscure the shameful treatment of others. But it was out of that persistent set of difficult circumstances that the student activists came. It wasn't the artist who carried the day. It was these brave young people who said, "Wait a minute. We've come to the table with all the respect we can muster, and you've done nothing. Now you will pay attention to us. How much more are you going to do to us? You can kill us. You can turn dogs on us and beat us, but you'll have to drag us away 10 at a time, and there will be hundreds more to take our place." The country just couldn't fathom it. To many, this upheaval seemed to come out of nowhere, because for such an unbearably long time, no attention had been paid to problems of racial inequality. Sammy Davis Jr., Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Lena Horne, Sidney Poitier, we weren't leading the charge. We weren't at the forefront getting our heads cracked open, though our careers were a reflection of what was possible when attention was paid. 25 years earlier, it hadn't been widely expected, with opportunities so meager, that blacks could be scientists, statesmen, artists. Every time I stepped out, I felt the responsibility to do whatever I could to make pending successes seem a natural expectation. During the mid-60s, I was approached for another project by Pandru Berman, the filmmaker who had produced Blackboard Jungle. Now, 10 years later, he wanted to do something called A Patch of Blue. Guy Green was to be the director, an English film editor who had gone into directing and had done some really impressive films. He had fallen in love with this material. I don't recall whether he had brought it to Pandru Berman or Pandru Berman had brought it to him. But when I was approached about the part, I read the script very, very carefully before having a talk with Guy Green as to how he saw the material, because this was a delicate matter, though a wonderfully original idea. A blinded white girl and a black guy who came into her life. You know, it was pregnant with all kinds of interesting possibilities, but it was also very tricky in terms of how society would receive it. There were many, many miscarriages that would have to be avoided in order to make something that was not only entertaining, but useful. I came away with the sense that this guy might have a good fix on the subject matter. Why did I feel that way? Was it because he was English? I don't think so. because the English are no less subject to frailties on questions of race than anybody else. But there was a humanity to the guy. I mean, I got really good vibes from him about how he saw the world. So I signed on. I went to rehearsals in the pre-filming preparation period and met a young lady named Elizabeth Hartman. She was a plain-looking, warm, delicate, and apparently fragile person, ideal for the part. I wasn't aware then, when I met her, that she had dressed herself down for the role. She was quite an attractive girl. She was also a well-trained young actress who had developed a strong technique. We started rehearsing, and I was struck by the magnificent work Elizabeth did. As for myself, I was traveling over ground I had never covered before, you know, and I was dipping into emotional pockets that were new to me. This was a white girl, and we were in 1960s America. This was a revolutionary attempt at filmmaking, so I was mentally awake in every way. I had my eye out, my ear out, and I was quite primed to make sure that nothing untrue, uncomplimentary, or stereotypical occurred. I wanted to make sure that the story was told with dignity and respect for the questions involved. This wasn't the story of an interracial couple, mind you. This was simply a guy trying to help a young girl who was in need. It was a human story. But this was also the time of the March on Selma, the first Civil Rights Act, and the sit-ins. A lot of stressful stuff was coming down. The question of race was rattling the country to its foundation. So everything in me was on the lookout. I had already predetermined what my character should look like from my point of view. I could be honest to my craft, and I could deliver this character in full. I mean really in full, including all of his weaknesses and all of his shortcomings. He would be a human being in total, not a one-dimensional cardboard replica of a human being, as is the case in too many movies, particularly movies about racial questions in America. I couldn't control how the rest of the movie would go. I didn't know how Shelley Winters was going to sketch the character of the girl's mother, for example. It was none of my business. I could raise objections only if I saw something that struck me as totally off the mark. But Shelley was a professional, and she not only brought to bear all the shortcomings of that character, all the prejudices of that character, all the imperfections of that character, she added more. And the more she added included character details of a fairly despicable person, but none of the characteristics were completely foreign to other human beings as well. The part of my brother was played by Ivan Dixon, a tremendous actor. He sculpted that part beautifully so that all the things I wanted to come out of the sequence between the two of us, Dixon and myself, they just flowed. And then there were, of course, peripheral characters, such as Elizabeth Hartman's grandfather. So everyone in the cast was doing super-duper work. And then, about a third of the way through, I really tuned in to where the director was coming from, and I relaxed completely. I knew that I was in good hands. I knew that his take on the material was such that he was going to be absolutely faithful to the story, but he was also going to be absolutely faithful to the humanity that was implied in the story. I am not always satisfied with my work in every scene, in every picture. But in A Patch of Blue, I was coming from a different place. And the performance, by my measurement, was absolutely on target, and I felt that all the way through. Much of this had to do with what I was getting from the other actors. They really kept me reaching for something I hadn't even been aware was in me. I saw the movie, and by God, it was a picture, a performance that was better than I thought I could manage. I mean, it was good work. The actors around me were really cooking, and much of their brilliance reflected on my performance, whether it was deserved or not. It had to reflect on my performance because I was the central character with this girl, and how things were with me and her, collectively and individually, was what those other characters were about. I played a likable guy. I played a good, decent, useful human being. And mind you, much of what was being made in Hollywood at that time, with rare exceptions, wasn't complimentary from the black perspective. It was a proud moment for me, especially when I thought back to Butterfly McQueen, Steppin' Fetch It, Hattie McDaniels, and Mantan Moreland. The Hollywood of an earlier day had made questionable use of such fabulous talents as Lena Horne and Rex Ingram and Ethel Waters, talents that were never given the respect of a truly objective evaluation. I mean, these were actors. I had been introduced to many of them when I was a youngster starting out. I had met Louise Beavers. I knew something of Mantan Moreland. I had met the man. I knew Rex Ingram, Bill Walker, Juanita Moore. I knew so many of those people. I had met them and found them three-dimensional human beings. Some were articulate. Some were ordinary in their speech patterns. Some were quite erudite. Some were just plain interesting people. But they all were reduced by the requirements of a racist society and an industry that knew how to reflect the society racially in only that one way. I mean, there were virtually no parts for black school teachers, for example, and if there were school children, they were all pickaninnies with their hair combed upwards as if their scalp had been electrified, and giggling, and their eyes rolling like buckwheat in the Our Gang comedies. Back in Los Angeles, in the bowels of the film industry, these people were close at hand, right over in West Los Angeles, towards the Central Avenue area, Adams area, Crenshaw area. And I saw the dignified homes they lived in, and I was in some of those homes. And I gotta tell you, it had to have been some massive negative attitude operative in society, and consequently in this industry, to characterize a people without the slightest acknowledgement of their humanity anywhere in sight. These artists are very much like the black actors and actresses I know today, only they were chained to stereotypes when some of them had the wherewithal to saw. They simply got no chance. They lived and died, never having an opportunity to express their genuine talent. I'm not racially sensitive to the point I want to foist untruths on my history. As a matter of fact, I am more inclined to critically examine that which I know to be the truth. So when I look at history through the black actors and actresses who preceded me, I need to be fair to those actors and actresses, but I also need to be fair to the society, you know. What good did the participation of blacks in the movie industry do for the actors and actresses who represented their race and to those actors and actresses? What harm did it do to them and to generations unborn? I put all that in the mix, and even so, all I can conclude is that Hollywood was a really insensitive place when it came to black people. We needed alternatives. In New York City, there were people like Oscar Michaud, a black man making movies there. But he had to put the finished product under his arm and go around from place to place to find cinema houses for black people, and there weren't very many of those. He was on the road all the time. Whenever he finished a picture, he went off traveling, putting his work in black theaters. He has become a kind of a father figure for the current black filmmakers in America, though, of course, they know of him only through the legend of what he did. There were other black film personalities making black pictures. There was a guy named Ralph Cooper in New York who was a very, very big film personality. He was an actor who played all kinds of parts, including romantic parts and gangster parts. There was also Herb Jeffries, the black singing cowboy. The studios wouldn't go near that kind of stuff in those days. So Mantan Moreland, Steppin' Fetch It, Butterfly McQueen, and Hattie McDaniels, they could only dream of a time when there would be a Denzel Washington, a Wesley Snipes, an Angela Bassett, a Will Smith, a Samuel L. Jackson, and a Morgan Freeman, when there would be an invention called television to harbor a legend named Bill Cosby. They would have to stretch their imagination pretty far to be able to dream in those terms. So I look back on those people who came before me, and I owe them a debt, you know? Yes, sometimes I squirmed when I watched what they had to do. Sometimes I applauded when something they did really touched my heart. But I knew when I came on the scene how painful it had to have been for them sometimes. Certainly not all the time, but sometimes it had to have been a bitch for them to say some of those words and behave in some of those ways. So I look back on them with respect and appreciation. They were my predecessors, and they endured. They were the ones that life and nature and history required to walk that road. They gave birth to me because a part of what I do, a part of what Denzel Washington does, a part of what Angela Bassett does, is to respectfully reflect on the endurance of those people. We were and are as they would have wished to be. But we could not be as we are without their having paid a price. Why do white folks love Sidney Poitier so? 1968 was a time of incredible conflict and contrast. It was the year when both Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated, the year Lyndon Johnson succumbed to the cultural clashes over Vietnam and gave up the presidency, the year of the police riot at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. But for me personally, it was also a year of tremendous professional satisfaction. I had the number one box office success as well as number two and number three, To Sir with Love with Lulu and Judy Geeson, In the Heat of the Night with Rod Steiger and Lee Grant, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And I think we did work that has more than stood the test of time. Yet, given the quickly changing social currents, there was more than a little dissatisfaction rising up against me in certain corners of the black community. A cultural wave that would crest a few years later when the New York Times published an article titled, Why Do White Folks Love Sidney Poitier So? The issue boiled down to why I wasn't more angry and confrontational. New voices were speaking for African Americans, and in new ways. Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown, the Black Panthers. According to a certain taste that was coming into ascendancy at that time, I was an Uncle Tom, even a house Negro, for playing roles that were non-threatening to white audiences, for playing the noble Negro who fulfills white liberal fantasies. In essence, I was being taken to task for playing exemplary human beings. The young engineer turned schoolteacher into Sir with Love, the Philadelphia homicide detective far from home in The Heat of the Night, and the young doctor who comes courting the daughter of Tracy and Hepburn in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Now, admittedly, the young teacher I portrayed was the epitome of virtue. Elegant and well-spoken, intelligent and kind, he was also courageous and steadfast as he stood up to abuse and maintained his commitment to the students under his charge. Police Detective Tibbs, likewise, was a man of great courage and intelligence as well as admirable restraint. And the young doctor in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, aside from being a charming suitor, an exceedingly courteous guest, and a paragon of a son, had academic credentials a mile long and spent his time saving mankind for the World Health Organization. So, the question being raised was, what's the message here? That black people will be accepted by white society only when they are twice as white as the most accomplished Ivy League medical graduate, that blacks must pretend to be something they're not, or simply that black society does, of course, contain individuals of refinement, education, and accomplishment, and that white society, of course, should wake up to that reality. The heated tempers of that time have long since cooled, and ideological fashions have come and gone. But the fact remains that in the late 60s, civil disobedience gave way to more radical approaches. The angry payback of the black exploitation film was just around the corner, and my career as a leading man in Hollywood was nearing its end. Even so, I think it's all too easy for anyone not a participant in the cultural clashes of that era to unfairly dismiss films such as Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, forgetting just how revolutionary they were in the context of their times. This was another Stanley Kramer picture, of course, and he's the kind of filmmaker who has always asked, "What can I do that will be daring, interesting, and necessary?" In 1967, when he had me read the script for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I was very impressed. Stanley knew that the country wasn't ready for this one, but his attitude was, well, we're going to do it anyway. One sign of the times was that he decided not to tell the folks at Columbia Pictures what the movie was about initially, and for good reason. He had a production deal with them for a certain number of pictures, so for a while at least, it was enough for him to say that he was going to make the next one with Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and Sidney Poitier. But that's all, he told them. Sounds great, they said. Go ahead and develop the script. And so he did. But after a point, he had to go to Columbia again, and he said, "We're really okay. We've come a long way, and I would just like to start putting this thing together." And they said, "Okay, now let's get this straight. It's Poitier and Tracy and Hepburn, and we are doing this movie, but what's it about?" "Family stuff," he said. "You know, this is family stuff." And the guys at Columbia nodded, and Stanley said, "It's going to be warm, it's going to be human, and it's going to be whatever." He still didn't really lay it out, but after a certain point, before the serious money was committed, the folks at Columbia had to see the script. They really had to know what they were buying. So Stanley said, "Look, I've got these three people. I've got Tracy and Hepburn. Do you know what that combination is? Do you know what that means?" And he's selling. He's telling them that they're running out of chances to get this team because Tracy isn't a young man. But the fact is, once they got their hands on the script, they really didn't want to go down that road. They felt that the subject was simply too much for an American audience, and they felt that the risk was too great. So they were squirming and they were dodging, and finally someone came up with what Columbia thought could be the loophole in their commitment. Tracy's health prevented the studio from getting him insurance coverage for the production. Legend has it that they tried to use that as an excuse for halting production, but then Tracy refused to take any salary until the film was over, which undercut that argument. So reluctantly, they acquiesced and let the picture proceed. Here's the story of how I was taken to Hepburn's house so she could check me out. When I arrived at her door and that door opened, she looked at me and didn't say a word and didn't crack a smile. But that was her M.O. After the longest while, she said, "Hello, Mr. Poitier." And I said, "Hello, Miss Hepburn." And the conversation began. I could tell that I was being sized up every time I spoke, every response I made. I could imagine a plus and a minus column, notations in her mind. That's how big a step this was for her, at least in my mind. After that first meeting, Stanley took me to Tracy's house on Doheny Drive for a little dinner party with the two of them and some other guests. This time, Miss Hepburn was much more natural and at ease, but it was still obvious that I was under close observation by both of them. The truth of the matter is that the formation